Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and very happy to have a very special guest today, Alan Malik, who is the author of Smaller Cities in a Shrinking World. But to call him that, to call him the author of a new book, really sort of would undersell Alan as really the dean of what I think of as legacy city cities. I've read Alan's work for years. Any of us in urban circles who's ever grappled with the idea of what do we do with the Rust Belt? How do we think about revitalizing the Great Lakes area, particularly in the climate discourse where I've spent that most recently? We've all read Alan's work. So, Alan, thank you for coming on Unfrozen.
Well, thank you. And that's very nice for you to say. I have no idea, actually, who reads my stuff, but it's nice to know that you're all out there.
Well, we're out there. Well, I would love to hear as an opening question, obviously, the sort of theme of the book. I think of your work often. It just occurred to me that the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling has a one-sentence description of the future in which he says, old people in cities frightened of the sky. And I think a lot of that of Japan and Europe and, you know, these aging populations in cities that are slowly depopulating, which is what we think of the opposite, because for years we've been obsessed with the megacity problem, like Mike Davis and Planet of Slums. But you're trying to reclaim the shrinking city as the future. I would love to hear your overall thesis.
Yeah, I believe this. What's happening is really amazing. You know, for the last, I guess, 50 years or so, 50, 60 years, we've been thinking about growth, either as a good thing or as a scary thing. The population bomb, the population explosion, megacities, teeming slums, and so forth. Well, population growth is slowing down. There are at least a couple of dozen countries in the world, including China and Japan, where the entire country has gone into negative growth, and that's going to be more and more true of more and more countries over the next few decades. And when countries start losing population, cities start losing population. And you have, in Sterling's words, more old people, fewer young people, and a whole series of consequences. Because the thing is, over the next couple of decades, not only is population growth going to slow down and turn negative in a lot of places, but we're also going to start seeing more and more of the impacts of climate change in terms of heat and sea level rise and the effect on economic productivity. We're going to see the effects of deglobalization, which is already going on. So this is going to be a very tough few decades, and one of the key features in it are going to be all of these shrinking cities in the United States, in Europe, in East Asia. And that's the contour of the future.
So this is portrayed as a kind of a coming reality, but not necessarily a proclamation of doom. You actually find quite a few silver and, dare I say, green linings in this shrinking city phenomenon. What are some of the things that, you know, I think city leaders need to come to terms with besides removing themselves from the gospel of growth?
Okay, that's the first thing, and that's hard enough. I think number one is removing yourself from the gospel of growth, accepting the idea that not only are you not likely to be growing that much, if at all, but that is not necessarily a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with having a flat or shrinking population as long as you acknowledge it and start thinking about how you're going to deal with it. The second thing is when you think about how to fuel your economy, is to start taking a step back from the notion that the way to grow jobs and investment and so forth is to try to catch some crumbs from the globalization. The globalized economy, because that economy is, I'm not saying it's going to disappear. You know, I don't have an apocalyptic scenario. I'm not pitching Mad Max, but it's going to get weaker. The growth is going to be less. The investment is going to be increasingly, I expect, hoarded by the more successful regions, be it the Austins or the Denvers or the Phoenixes, though that's questionable, of the world. And so that means if you're going to succeed as a city that's not growing and that's a small city somewhere off from the economic mainstream, which is true of most of the United States, then you have to start looking at some significant alternative ways of building your economy. You also, especially in a world of climate change and rising temperatures and natural disasters, you also have to be thinking about how to make yourself a more sustainable city from an environmental standpoint. And the two go side by side. And how to use your human resources, how to really connect with and make the most of the human capital that exists in the city, instead of hoping that somehow a whole bunch of people will come from, you know, California or somewhere to save you.
All right, well, that's where I want to start by pushing back a little bit, Alan, there, because while, of course, in the long run, at global scale, your thesis is undoubtedly correct. We know from UN population estimates that at one point we will have a global shrinking population and we'll have tons of urban fabric that will never be reclaimed. I mean, Japan, ultimate case, you're right, 800,000 population loss in the last year, abandoned homes and cities increasingly in the countryside. Like, I always thought of that as a bellwether of our urban future. But in the short run, for example, for U.S. cities, or even in Europe with the post-Syrian refugee crisis, there we saw depopulated German towns gaining new foreign migrants and revitalizing city centers. And we've seen in Maine, for example, Somali immigrants have helped increase the total net population of Maine. And there's also the climate migrant discourse of the notion of, should we be moving people out of harm's way from cities in high-risk climate areas to formerly underpopulated cities? Is there an intermediate growth scenario, or is that fool's gold for these places? How do you interpret those numbers?
Okay, well, first, the whole issue of migration is the big wild card in this whole conversation, because, you know, not every place is going to be shrinking. In fact, over the next decades, the one part of the world, maybe two parts, that will continue to grow at a pretty steady clip are Africa and the Middle East. Pretty much everybody else is on a clear, short-term demographic downward trajectory. They're on a downward trajectory, but it's much more long-term. So we're looking at 7,500 years or more. So there is going to be part of the world which is going to have a growing population, and in all likelihood, given climate change, given governance and infrastructure problems, is not going to be able to provide a decent living or opportunity for all the young people who are coming along in those places. So there is a large pool of potential immigrants out there. Germany is a good example. Germany has, with a certain amount of resistance from part of its population, embraced immigration. Germany now has more foreign-born residents as a percentage of the population than the United States. But at the same time, that's, you know, it's a politically controversial issue. My estimates, my projections, by the way, the UN numbers, I think, and the people I consider the best demographers in the world agree with me, or I agree with them because they're the experts. They're too, I don't know, optimistic. They're too high. They've been consistently too high, and they keep scaling back. The best guess is that the world will go into negative population growth around 2070. If the United States had zero immigration, we would be going into negative population growth within less than a decade. Depending on the amount of immigration, that could change. So immigration is a big wild card and could change things for a lot of places. But at the same time, there are a lot of places that might not change that much, especially the Rust Belt, the Old South, you know, places like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, that are already losing population, the Plain States. There's a large belt in this country that is unlikely to benefit that much from immigration. The other thing, I think there's going to be climate migration eventually. I mean, you know, how long can people stand it in Phoenix? But people adapt as best they can, so it's not going to happen that soon. And then, I mean, I'm thinking, if I were a typical Phoenician and I decided to move, would I move to Detroit? Would I move, God help me, to Duluth? Not likely. Maybe I'd move to Raleigh. Maybe I'd move to Atlanta. Might even move to Dallas. Places that are not that different, but just enough cooler that they're bearable. So I think the climate migration is not a solution for the Rust Belt.
Interesting. But I also want to ask about the flip side. I mean, you mentioned Germany, right? And immigration and the political consequences of that. But the flip side of that is also true in terms of the political consequences when it comes to growth. I mean, asking struggling places to turn their back on growth also runs the risk of political polarization. I mean, Germany's seeing this with the rise of AfD. They've got a rising right-wing party that's almost purely concentrated. The highest numbers are in the former GDPR. In Spain, you have a right-wing party. We know that the Spanish countryside is emptying out. This shrinking city thing seems to be part of the increasing polarization as younger people migrate to the major centers. How do you think we defuse that, like, political time bomb and accept that degrowth?
That, to me, that movement is very much a byproduct of the growth ethos and the globalization ethos that we're trapped in. Because why are people, and the same is true of the people who are the Trump supporters to a large extent in the United States. These are people that look at their communities, and these communities have basically been shafted by the global economy. And in a way, what I'm suggesting is, and maybe this is an answer to that, is that some of these communities have more assets locally or can take advantage of technology to build more assets locally than they appreciate, and maybe can actually become healthier places than they are now. Now, I don't want to suggest that this is easy. It is extraordinarily difficult at any number of levels. But I think it's possible. And maybe it's a way out, because I think realistically, if we continue along the same path, that polarization, which is leading to, you know, the growth of these hard right-wing movements and the hostility to immigration and all that, is going to get worse, not better.
Thinking a little bit more optimistically, there's a concept that you introduce in this book called networked localism. This idea that, well, I'll let you articulate what that is.
Okay, it's a combination of things. It's sort of a cluster of different ideas around the basic premise is that cities can use a combination of their internal resources and the amazing technologies that have evolved over the last couple of decades to build economies that are significantly more locally oriented, self-sufficient, and not dependent on the global economic system than is currently the case. Now, I'm not suggesting that they secede from the global system. I mean, a small city they're not going to make smartphones, they're not going to make their own automobiles, and a bunch of things. But at the same time, they can do an awful lot. And it's a combination of, I'd say, four or five different pieces. One is local manufacturing and taking advantage of what's known as distributed manufacturing, small-scale CNC devices, and so forth, to start making things that can be made with raw materials that are readily at hand, with software that's available from open sources, and so forth. A second area is local energy, distributed energy, microgrids, self-sufficient renewable sources, and so forth. A third, I'd say, would be called sort of remote systems. And there are a whole bunch. One is remote work, which means that people can and do increasingly live in places that are well removed from the major mega centers of activity. Also, remote education, which means that they're, especially in higher education, you can create opportunities that are on a par with major cities through remote and hybrid learning. Thirdly, remote healthcare, which one thing that amazed me is the fact that if you have some kind of a brain tumor and you're in some small city in Kansas, assuming that city has a clinic with the right robot, you could have your surgery done by the top neurosurgeon in the Midwest sitting in her office in Chicago or Cleveland. I mean, and there's lots more like that. So that's, and then another is the whole question of environmental sustainability, which is part of that, which is dealing with such things as building increasing local agriculture, what I think of as not so much urban agriculture as peri-urban agriculture, taking advantage of the region around a city. Open space, dealing with sewer overflows, dealing with heat islands, basically creating a more environmentally sustainable place. And so when I think of network localism, it's all of those pieces, but all of them plugged into the kind of technology that allows you to do this stuff today without severing yourself from the global economy and without having to reinvent a whole lot of wheels.
Right. So on the one hand, it's not like saying the machines will save us, but it's also not saying we have to all form kibbutzes, you know, and go back to the land. It's more a case of we need to better integrate technology with localism than it currently is, right? Instead of being like an instrument of domination by the global capital.
Well, and Alan, I mean, what are some examples you think are doing this successfully? I mean, in the States, like, I was inspired by Cooperation Jackson, which was the sort of effort by Jackson, Mississippi, to rethink its local economies. For the New Republic, years ago, I wrote about Renew Newcastle, which is sort of an Australian Rust Belt city that was trying to revitalize local. What do you talk about in the book that you think is sort of like points to with facts on the ground about what this model could evolve?
Okay, there's no one place that I can say has put all this together. But you look at, so for example, there are bits and pieces. So for example, there's a small city in Lithuania called Šiauliai or something like that, which has built a biomass plant that heats most of the city and provides about 15% of their electricity. And is, you know, Burlington, Vermont, has a strategy of becoming essentially completely based on renewable energy, of which about half is generated locally from local sources, including a hydroelectric plant on the Winooski River. You know, Ithaca, New York, which has an amazing food co-op, which, you know, and you think of food co-op as a little store with a couple of, bags of people picking over potatoes or obscure ancient grains. We're talking about an operation that has grown into where it has one major full-service supermarket, two satellite stores, a membership list which includes probably about a quarter of the households in the county. And they are, along with a local farmer-owned farmer's market, which has a downtown pavilion and so forth, and the support of the county, are trying to develop a plan for, if not total, but increased food self-sufficiency for Tompkins County, New York. So, I mean, there are lots of pieces. There's a company in the UK that develops open source software for CNC machines, where you can make anything from houses to prosthetic arms locally using normal raw materials, not exotic or rare earths or metals that you have to source from Congo. Again, using a machine that you can buy for $25,000 and put on the top of a workbench. So the pieces are there. And so just along those lines, there are cities all over the country now that have what are usually called maker spaces. And these, which are basically usually large facilities outfitted with a whole variety of these types of machines as well as other stuff and stocks of raw materials. Now, currently, again, given the nature of the economy that we function in, makerspace, the people who operate out of makerspaces typically build or make what you might call niche stuff. Jewelry, very special, you know, specialized, one-of-a-kind furniture, things like that and so forth. That's, again, a function not of the technology, but a function of its role in the current economy. Those are unbelievably adaptable to making all of the stuff that normal people use during the course of their lives.
So when I think about shrinking cities, you know, probably the first one that comes to mind is actually cited pretty extensively in your book as an example of two different dynamics, which I'd like to address because they're happening in one place at the same time. One is downtown revival, and the other is rewilding or urban farming or some combination thereof of the vast periphery. I'm of course speaking of Detroit, you know, where you have a downtown that's being revitalized seemingly single-handedly by one person. And then, you know, the last time I was in Detroit driving in a peripheral neighborhood, I had to swerve to avoid a tree in the middle of the road. It had not fallen. It had not been planted there. It was just growing in a pothole. And, you know, is there a way that those two dynamics can meet up so that Detroit can shrink, you know, successfully, if that's an expression, as opposed to catastrophically or inequitably?
Yeah. Detroit is a fascinating case. I mean, Dan Gilbert, who owns Quicken Loans and about 100 other companies, has put, along with his investors and partners and so forth, by some estimates, something like $4 to $5 billion into rehabbing buildings, creating a public realm and so forth in downtown Detroit, as well as moving tens of thousands of workers into downtown Detroit. And there's no question that it's had a spectacular impact. An area that 15, 20 years ago was almost completely empty is now full of activity and life. At the same time, you're right, it is not an equitable form of development. It's a model that has largely benefited middle-class people, young, tech-minded college graduates, and disproportionately white people. You know, it's a city that's three-quarters black. You walk around downtown, you go to a restaurant, you see three-quarters or more white faces. So I think the city of Detroit, as a city government, is very much aware of the importance of trying to expand the base beyond downtown and create opportunities and improve quality of life for the people in the rest of the city. At the same time, I don't think they have an awful lot of imagination or vision about how to go about it. And I think they're very heavily dependent still on the notion that manufacturing and the global economy is the way to create jobs for the people of Detroit. I think they have been, you know, reluctant to embrace large-scale, long-term greening strategies, even though, you know, they support, there are lots of sort of mini agriculture efforts, but there's no overall greening strategy in Detroit. So I think what I would do if I were working with them is to say, basically, let's take a step back and let's look at the limitations of the current strategy or the current approach, and let's see, how can we do better? How can we really start thinking about things that would be transformative in terms of the rest of the city, whether in terms of open space, whether in terms of economic opportunity, creating the kind of things that would create jobs, how to integrate people into the economy more strongly. I think Detroit has a lot of work to do, but they've gotten off to a decent start. I mean, the downtown is important. It's brought the city to some extent back to life. It started to bring some energy and some money into the city, and it's a start. But I think now it's really time that they really start thinking much more broadly about their future. And not just the next 2, 3, 4 years, but 10, 20, 30 years. I think we don't have a lot of vision on the part of cities in this country. We could use some.
Yeah, Alan. Well, I mean, speaking of Detroit, I mean, obviously we're 10 years past the bankruptcy and the city's recovered a bit from the epic images of entirely fallow and abandoned neighborhoods. But what do you recommend? I mean, if we assume that urban footprints will shrink, what do you think are the best uses of some of that reclaimed land? I mean, you know, there's a lot of discussion of urban farming in the general discourse, and, you know, and in Detroit, of course, that, you know, they had a whole program where you could basically buy the vacant lot next to you for a dollar and was sort of left up to private citizens. Have you seen any sort of interesting far-sighted programs about, you know, how to maximize the highest available use of space in these cities as the urban frontier, let's call it, reopens?
Not really. But some thoughts about it. I think part of the problem is, and I tell this story in my book about one city which has tens of thousands of vacant lots, of which maybe about 100 get redeveloped in a good year. And that when I and some colleagues had proposed that they start doing a systematic effort of identifying which areas might not be candidates for develop and start thinking about permanent green uses for those areas, the deputy mayor said, "Never. That's a recipe for defeat." Okay, that mindset is still very pervasive. And I think until people start to take a step back and say, there's nothing wrong with green reuse as a permanent strategy, and being realistic about what the opportunities for regrowth really are, I think they're going to have a hard time thinking strategically about this. So we get bits and pieces. Frankly, I think urban agriculture is a great thing at all kinds of levels. It is not a solution to food security because it tends to be on a small scale. There are a lot of issues that come up in terms of soil quality and so forth, which again, make it hard to maximize production. I think if a city is really serious about food security, it should start working with the surrounding counties where the agricultural land is and starting to encourage farmers to convert from the standard corn and soybeans model to locally oriented intensive vegetable and fruit and small livestock raising. That, I think, is the track for food security. And I think it's very doable. The amount of land that you need to provide all the food that a small Midwestern city can eat is extraordinarily small compared to the amount of land that's devoted to corn and soybeans. But I think it's important to look at urban agriculture is valuable. I think, you know, in Detroit, they actually they gave somebody a whole bunch of lots to put up a tree farm. And I think it looks great. I would reforest a lot of areas. There are some amazing methods that have been developed. One thing that's quite well known is what's known as the Miyazaki method, is a way of planting and nourishing different types of trees and so forth to create a multiple species, forest, in extraordinarily small areas. You could take, you know, plots that are half an acre or less and create actually a viable small forest. So I'd say reforestation, the whole area of creating natural means for storm runoff, which I think is going to be increasingly important as we have more intense storms. I think a lot of cities in the United States, as well as elsewhere, wouldn't know what to do if they got a really heavy-duty storm the way we're going to get more and more of. You know, you could have a flood. If you got 6, 8, 10 inches of rain in a few hours in Detroit, which is possible today, you could have flooding like you wouldn't believe, not to mention the fact that your sewer system would basically just totally seize up. So starting to think about those issues, I think, is tremendously important, and using open space to help solve some of those things. One idea I remember pushing without any success when I was working about, this is about 12 years ago, on the Detroit Future City strategic plan was, I mean, this in the context of creating opportunities for storm runoff, I said, why don't we find an area that's large enough to accommodate it and create a lake? It would not only, you know, be a good environmental resource, but it would be a visual and recreational amenity. You know, there's a wonderful project in Dortmund about, I don't know, this goes back maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the city decommissioned, it was, I think, the last steel mill in the city limits. And by the time they'd done all the environmental cleanup and removed all the stuff from the soil and everything, about a good half of the site was now about 10 feet below the surrounding grade. And so they said, okay, what are we going to do with the damn thing? Well, it happens to be less than a quarter of a mile from the Emscher River. So somebody said, why don't we landscape the perimeter of the site and create sort of terraces for housing development, and in the center of the site, turn it into a lake. And it's called the Phoenix Lake. And it's gorgeous. It is utterly gorgeous. And at this point, the houses that they built around it are selling for, I don't know, €1 million or so forth in a basically still struggling old industrial city.
Yeah, I'm just thinking this through. Are the solutions largely in civil works, do you think, or should we be looking at private developers? What kind of infrastructure can we put in that would encourage the kind of collaboration that seems not to have happened too much so far?
Well, I mean, obviously, you might get lucky and get a Dan Gilbert, but I think, you know, we want to have private developers. Private developers are a big part of the picture. And I think ultimately, a city that does not have a housing market, which is at least of some interest to private developers, is going to be in trouble, which is true of a lot of the cities, you know, in the Midwest. A lot of these shrinking Rust Belt cities basically have very little of a housing market. Now, in Detroit, at this point, I think you have a functioning housing market in downtown. In Midtown, which is the area just north of downtown where Wayne State and the major medical centers are located, and a couple of areas off to one side. So I think you want to involve the private developers, but realistically, I think the public sector has to be willing to prime the pump to a large extent. which means provide funds for creating the kind of infrastructure and public realm that makes it an area attractive to developers, providing things like tax abatements, making sure that there are enough subsidies so that there's affordable housing mixed in the mix. And that's a critical piece of it, and it can be very expensive. To go back to the Dortmund example, in round numbers, before they could break ground on any of the housing, the city and the state had put in something like €400 million in infrastructure and site preparation. This is a huge project, so I'm not talking about a small block, but even so, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about where the money would come from in any given jurisdiction is a big part of the puzzle here, because there first has to be the political will, and then there has to be the ability to locate sources of funding. Are there organizations that are helping municipalities do this, or helping, for that matter, you know, state or federal governments do this at a bigger scale?
Well, I'm not sure that I can think of any specifically on that point. I think two things about the funding. One, a lot of the stuff I'm talking about is not particularly expensive. And one of the things is trying to really use local talent and energy and so forth to help make it happen. Like a lot of these small-scale manufacturing or greening things don't require hundreds of millions of dollars in investment. Again, the machinery, the what goes into changing a landscape and so forth, this is relatively manageable. When you talk about some of the larger scale things, especially housing and development, that's a lot more expensive. If you're talking about large scale industry or so forth, that's off the charts. But so I think we certainly need at least some resources to get this started. And these cities, by and large, do not have those kinds of resources. Now, a large city like Detroit can probably scare up a certain amount to focus on that. They're also large enough to get the attention of the federal government without too much difficulty, and foundations, so forth. Smaller cities, the smaller you get and the shrinkinger you get, the harder it is. And one thing, just on this, I would love to see this country at the national level, or for that matter, any major state, really start thinking about a place strategy. If we don't have, and have not had for a long, long time, if ever, a strategy in this country that looks at how do we strengthen places because of their value as places where people live, people work, and people go. We currently have an odd sort of place strategy going on in that, you know, the CHIPS Act and the other federal investments are triggering hundreds of billions of dollars in industrial investment in this country. And by the law of averages, some of that might end up in places that need it. But an awful lot of it is going to, in fact, I looked at the actual numbers from jobs and dollars, and about 40% of all the money so far committed in the country is going to the Phoenix and Austin, Texas areas. So it's about places, yeah. It's geographically specific, but it's not about the places themselves. The places are more or less randomly selected based on criteria totally irrelevant to the needs of the community.
Although related to that, Alan, again, just to push back slightly, or some, thinking about some of the post-pandemic economic geography of the states, is like the big outflows that are happening that we see in census data, you know, the continuing outflow from New England and the mid-Atlantic states and the Midwest to the Sun Belt, Texas, Florida, again, areas of highest climate risk, are popularly described as functions of housing affordability. That's where the permits are being issued. That's where the housing starts are. It's perverse that, you know, we're seeing those outflows into these higher risk areas, but it's happening. And so it raises the question of, like, you know, if you, with the stroke of a pen, would you eliminate any NIMBY opposition to housing starts in the Midwest and New England? We would start to see that outflow reverse. Like, what are your sympathies or rebuttals to that sort of, you know, quasi-libertarian strategy of, like, slash the red tape, you know, basically build wherever you possibly can and the people will come?
Well, the first thing is, there are a relatively small number of places people are moving to in this country, and a much, 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 much larger number of places people are moving from. And in an awful lot of the places people are moving, and there, people are moving from places for two reasons. There are some of them, like, let's say, coastal California or parts of the New York metro, say, are because of high housing costs. But most of them are because of lack of opportunity. I mean, you know, people don't leave West Virginia because the houses are expensive, or Elmira, New York. I mean, you know, the houses are not expensive. In most of the United States, housing is cheap. But the thing about Texas and Arizona is, at least in relative terms, these are areas that are seeing extraordinary job growth and relatively affordable housing prices. But the main reason they're affordable is only partly because of the fact that regulation is relatively light touch. A big part of it is, you look at Texas and Arizona, these are places where there is an almost infinite availability of relatively flat, dry, empty land. And that's what's fueling it. Now, you look at, say, the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, clearly, there's some good reason for changing some of the zoning regulations in that area and allowing greater density, though I happen to believe that maintaining traditional neighborhoods and things like that in community, established communities, is not something that is worth just lightly throwing out in order to get higher density housing. But there are plenty of places where you could increase density and reduce the regulations and simplify a lot of the procedures and so forth. But if you look at the extent to which that area has been built up, right up to the water at one end and up to the mountains in the other, and you look at the constraints imposed by the geography and the topography, you can't replicate what's going on in San Antonio or Phoenix in the California Bay Area. And I think anybody who thinks that by changing the zoning you're going to be able to do so is basically blowing smoke.
So do you think your discussion of land availability, you know, naturally leads to the other fundamental discussion, which is water availability. So one of the big arguments that people are going to be repatriating to places like Detroit and Chicago and the upper Midwest is because of its access to Great Lakes water and fresh water in general, which is a problem increasingly in these desert Southwest locations, and arguably even on the shorelines where seawater infiltration is also a potential problem. Do you foresee that happening in a big way and benefiting anything other than the already established large cities in those regions, or not?
I don't know. I mean, these things are a lot more complicated than, you know, some people tend to imagine that they are, because after all, if you're deciding to pick up and leave Phoenix or Vegas or a place, it's going to be a complicated decision. And you're going to be making your choice. Once you've made the threshold decision to leave, your choice is going to be made on the basis of a whole lot of different criteria. And my guess is the relative degree of water supply is going to be pretty low on the list. In other words, obviously, you want to go to an area that where water will come out of the faucet when you turn it on. But that's basically all you're looking for. No, I doubt that too many people are going to say, I don't think I'm going to go to Dallas because they only have a 20-year guaranteed water supply, and in Detroit it's infinite. People, I mean, if people had that long-term calculus in mind, they probably wouldn't go to Phoenix in the first place. So I just don't think that's going to be a huge factor.
I guess a question would be, you know, I was taking it down a scale a little bit, you know, from these broader urban and federal or state level decision-making processes. Do you, from an architectural perspective, do you think there's anything to be said about the, I don't know, the rediscovery of people's interest in rehabbing houses, for example? I mean, could any of these HGTV shows take us to places like Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and rehab a old teetering Victorian? I mean, I know that sort of seems like a very bespoke solution to a broad problem, but media attention really does count for something. And I just wonder if, you know, that sort of energy that people have to constantly be rebuilding their houses could be redirected into areas that could really use some investment.
I think there's some of that. I think there definitely are people who would like to rehab or move into old Victorian houses. And I think the remote work explosion, which we've seen, creates some real opportunities along those lines. That said, I think it's going to be selective. I think it's going to be very selective. In other words, I think there's a pool of people out there who have some energy, some decent paying jobs, the ability to work remotely, and an interest in that kind of architecture, history, etc. But I think when they start to look where to go, they're going to look to places that already have a kind of a decent amenity level to begin with. They're not going to want to go to a place that they're like going to be the first person who is moved into that town in the last 50 years kind of thing. I'll give you an example. My stepson and his family live in a small city in upstate New York called Oneonta. It's has not been a prosperous community, but it's an absolutely gorgeous one. It's full of neighborhoods with old Victorian houses. It's got a lovely Victorian downtown with a place, very nice place, you can get a latte. It has a nice river. The Susquehanna River runs at the foot of the mountain. It's got hills, mountains, farms all around it, and so forth. It's gorgeous. When the pandemic hit, real estate in Oneonta started going flying off the shelves. Kingston, New York, which is closer to Manhattan, same thing. Bethlehem, PA. But these are places that already had a kind of a threshold level of amenity value that people could see, hey, this is a place I'd enjoy living in. So that's a very important thing. And I think one thing cities can start thinking about, if let's say you've got a city that does have a lot of old, nice old houses and some decent bones in the downtown, what can they do to make their, give their city more of what the realtors call curb appeal? Because amenities are a huge factor in people making their decision about where to live.
That's something that I can't see a politician disagreeing with, is that we need more amenities in the town. It's just these kinds of decisions that have been made historically have been, as you point out in the book, things like, let's put a casino in, let's put a convention center in, let's put in some giant faceless thing with giant parking lot that may draw people from the wider region, but only episodically, as opposed to, you know, building the firmware, shall we say, of a community. So I think that if, you know, it seems like if energy can be redirected toward that type of thing, there might be hope for some of these towns.
I think it's possible. again, I come back, it's difficult, and the sad thing is, you know, I mentioned before places like Burlington, Vermont, Ithaca, New York, so forth, that are kind of leading the charge on some of this stuff. Well, these happen to be communities that are, if not wealthy, at least they're not poor, they're at least moderately affluent. They're communities that have extraordinarily high levels of highly skilled university graduates with all kinds of technical skills to do stuff. These aren't the places that need it most. And when you look at most American small shrinking cities and so forth, there's a real deficit of specialized skills that are needed to put these kind of things together. There are also issues of, you know, political will and capability and so forth, but there are a lot of gaps in terms of the skill sets and the commitment, so forth, that are needed to get this stuff off the ground.
Well, Alan, I really want to thank you for spending the time with us. This is quite interesting, and it's you know, especially for, you know, my organization is the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, and we are always repeating the United Nations statistics about growing megacities and how are we going to house all these people, and we have to build. So this is a very interesting counter narrative to be addressing, where it's like, yes, and while we are addressing the problem of megacities, we also need to address the problem of shrinking cities, because one is feeding the other.
Yeah, and there are going to be more shrinking cities and fewer megacities in the future. And by the way, along those lines, last couple of years, guess which city has become a shrinking city? Calcutta.
Who would have thought? Really?
Who would have thought? Exactly.
Well, you've upended all kinds of received notions here just in this hour. So I want to thank you again, Alan. And that's Alan Melek. He's the author of Smaller Cities in a Shrinking World, Learning to Thrive Without Growth.
Great. Thank you. Again. It's been a pleasure.